Welcome to the Groups Matter podcast. I'm Brian Daniel, and I'm here with Rick Howerton. So, Rick, it's October already.
Yeah, man, feels like fall outside.
Well, there's a good reason for that.
Leaves are dropping.
You got this. I got to be honest with you. As much as I love summer, fall is probably my favorite time of year, but I don't like what's on the other side of it. So summer, I mean, I've got this real complicated approach to the seasons, right? I mean, I understand. I see the way you're looking at me. But fall is my favorite time of year. You got college football, baseball's winding down. You know, the cranky air is giving away to that nice 65 to 80. The days are a little shorter, but they're still pretty long. It's just a great time of year.
Those of you that are listening from Florida, call me. I'd love to come and do a conference during the fall. It's always cooler than I like it, but I do understand how you can like the fall.
Oh, so you're more of a summer guy, too, then.
Oh, yeah. I like the warm weather. Fall is just a reminder to me that it's going to get cold soon. Oh,
gosh, I used to deal with winter so much better than what I do now.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
I mean, any day less in the cold that I have to spend, I'm for it.
There you
Whatever it takes.
You're a wise man.
And we've
got
it easy here. And in Middle Tennessee, I mean, this is moderate. But anyway, fall's a great time of year. We've got another great show today.
Great stuff.
Appreciate you guys being with us. We have, Jeremy Linneman is going to be calling in shortly from Sojourn Church Louisville, Kentucky. The home front, the homestead.
Yeah, I met Jeremy, not so long ago. One of the sharpest young guys I've met in a long time, doing a great job at a great church.
So what's he going to be talking about?
He's going to be talking about a real controversial issue, actually, in a lot of church systems, and that is group multiplication. Whether or not to multiply groups, why you multiply groups, and is that really a good idea?
Yeah, I'm against it.
Well, you're going to enjoy my conversation.
Actually, I'm not. I know, but there are people that are adamantly against. And once groups get going and get comfortable with each other, that's a tough assignment for a group leader to come in and say, okay, now that you've gotten comfortable and you know everybody, it's time to split up and do something else.
You're right. I think Jeremy's going to get into some of that for us. That'll be helpful.
And so you've got the blog of the week, which looks interesting to me. 4 reasons why praying leaders have faster growing groups. Go figure.
Well, yeah, Jim Egli is one of the leading voices in group and statistics. He's also a group's pastor, and he did a great blog post on this topic. We're going to be diving into that in just a second.
And then Rick's list towards the end of the show, I think one of our more popular segments is the 4 levels of relationship, why it's important to you and your small group.
Yeah, I was pondering relationship and the kinds of relationships people have, and I realized, at least in my assumption, that there are 4 types of relationships. And when we can understand those 4 types, it gives us a better grasp on how we're relating to our group members.
Well, it's an incredible Groups Matter podcast we've got slated for this so welcome of months. Even though we're dreading what's on the other side, we'll just live for the day.
Let's do it.
All right, let's go. So let's go ahead and get going with the blog of the week.
Yeah, Jim Egli, as I mentioned, is a leading voice in the group's world. He has done some great writing. He wrote a great book that gives you a lot of the information that you'd like to hear about groups called Small Group Big Impact. And in his blog one day, he wrote the 4 reasons why praying leaders have faster growing groups. Here's what he says. First of all, let me just say that his research involved over 4,000 group leaders and came to this conclusion. Praying leaders have faster growing groups, which is what everybody's looking for. And he gives 4 simple reasons for this. The first is that God answers prayer. I mean, I know that seems so simplistic, but the truth is, I think sometimes we miss this. Sometimes group leaders get so busy preparing for the meeting, making sure there's food, getting the house cleaned up, that they forget the most important aspect of group life is God, and that God will work if we call upon Him. Simply, God answers prayer. The second point he makes is that praying leaders are compassionate, and when group leaders are praying for their members, they capture God's heart for them. You can't be in communication with God and not have the compassion that Jesus had for others. He makes that an intuitive activity within you if you are being in prayer consistently with Him.
Yeah, we've talked about in this context before. You and I have talked on the show even about the posture of prayer. And if you have a posture of prayer, I think that automatically gives way to that compassion you're talking about, because you're listening to people, your group members, the people around you. You're in tune. You're looking for ways that you can be praying for people, and that comes off, and that's translated as compassion.
Well, Brian, and as you said that, what came to my mind was a person who is in a posture of prayer is also in a posture of humility, because when you come before God, you realize how great He is and how minimal you are in comparison, and you find yourself feeling really equal to others.
Yeah, right. And clearly, it's ordering. It's one of those ordering disciplines that you understand your place in the universe in relationship to everything that's going on around you.
Yeah, that's important. That's great. The third point he makes is that God directs praying leaders. We often want to remind leaders that the best decision they can make is a decision that they didn't make, that God spoke to them and gave them direction. And as we pray, we not only talk to God, we hear from God. His fourth point is that praying leaders invite God's presence. He makes a great statement in the paragraph that follows that particular topic, and he says, people don't need us, they need God. And when we can realize God's presence and draw people into God's presence, they begin to experience God's presence, and they are transformed. And the group grows when people are being transformed. They hear the stories of group members who are being transformed, and they're seeing life change in them, and they want a piece of that action.
It looks like, you know, when you talk about prayer in a group and really prayer in general, is it too much to say, or does it feel rote to talk about a strategy for prayer? Because a lot of times I think prayer is communicated, and really, indeed, and in practice, it comes off as this one-off almost. And it's something that we portion off a part of our day for, but don't make it a part or a lifestyle choice. And it looks like, just looking at this, taking this post into consideration, what we're talking about are some measures you can take to make prayer, to be more fully engaged in prayer, to make it more holistic, more of a part of your role as a group leader, instead of just something you may do for several minutes of a day, which there's nothing, I mean, I'm not being critical of that approach, but hopefully that spills over, becomes something bigger than that, to where it becomes a mindset, or like what we said, as a posture.
Well, here's what we know. The scripture says to pray constantly. So if something comes to mind that needs God's intended work, we want to then speak to God. If we set aside a time, and it doesn't become legalistic, it is a time when I'm meeting with someone, not having a meeting with myself so I can say I had a meeting. When I come to meet with God and choose to realize His presence and then respond by speaking with Him and making a request of Him, it is at that point that we feel great about our prayers, because they're not institutionalized. They're not a checklist, one of the checklists that gets marked off. And I think that's what Jim's saying. I think Jim, if he were sitting here, is a very humble guy. I think he would, just in his gracious, kind way, say to us, if you love your people, you pray for your people.
Yeah, and there's no one's going to be listening to this podcast that's going to dispute the value and the power and the import of prayer in any aspect of life. But I do think that we need to, from time to time, revisit how we are making that a part of our daily lives and our group life. You know, how do you bring that into the group? Is it just something you do at the beginning and end? Is it something that you devote a large portion of group time to have that quiet and that? And then how do you do it? You do it intercessory? Does one person lead? One of the things that I think works is to pray for the person on your left, you know, and tell them that prior to having that group time, and so that you're really listening to what that person on your left is saying. But there's lots of different ways that you can approach it, even inside the group space.
Yeah, inside the group space, it seems too often to be a beginning and an end rather than an experience where you're coming before God together. And when that happens, it loses any impact at all.
Yeah, think about what that communicates. It becomes a prelude and an afterthought instead of a discipline in and of itself.
Yeah, when prayer is a bookend on each end of a group meeting, you don't really exist realizing God is in the room, because he's a secondary thought. most groups, I think, struggle with spending lots of time making prayer requests but never really praying. Many groups would be wise just to say, we're going to pray.
All right, let me ask you this question. Have you been asked or have you spoken into that part of the prayer request part of group, and how have you answered that question? Putting you on the spot here.
You mean practically?
Yeah.
Oh, there are some great ideas. One of them is just what you just said. Have every person give a one-sentence request, prayer request. There's bound to be something they want people to pray for, and then the person to the left prays for them. You have to be careful because you may have people in the room that don't pray aloud, so you have to give them an out. So, and if you've got unbelievers in the room, you've really put them in an awkward position. So that's one option. Another option is to give every person in the room a 3x5 card and ask them to write down a prayer request or two prayer requests. And then the person who's to their left or to their right or whomever, you can just take these off to another part of the house. And you can pray individually, silently, and then we'll come back and have a group prayer. Another option that we use in our group often is that people present prayer requests, and then the leader of the group assigns a person, a different person than the person who gave the prayer request. They give them the opportunity. They assign who would be willing to pray for Joe's request, who'd be willing to pray for Sally's request, and I'll close when everybody's finished. So there are multiple good ways to revisit the prayer time. The most important thing about prayer time, in my personal opinion, is to tell people, we're only going to pray for those people who are very close to you. I mean, direct family, very close friends. We don't want to get into, you know, the person you work with on Tuesdays that's having a hard time right now. We'd rather not do that. If we don't stay focused, we don't really get anywhere.
How have people reacted to that? Are they thankful?
Well, the thing is this, when you establish at the beginning of the group, when you're the group leader and you're the new group leader, and you establish that I will be leading, not just facilitating conversation, and you get to speak into everything we do, don't misunderstand me. It's not bad for the group to be involved in making decisions for the group. But when you establish that I'm trying to lead this group to a good end, and that is for you to become mature disciples and for us to connect with God, very seldom does somebody push back and say, oh, wait a minute, that just doesn't seem fair. Especially if you can explain that if we start going to all these far-reaching people, we'll never get to pray for the folks and the needs you really want us to pray for.
All right, quite a bit of follow-up to this post, and I think prayer in groups, like we agree, everyone understands the significance and the importance of prayer in groups, but just how that is carried out, I think, is something that we need to constantly be revisiting and thinking about. And I think follow-up on prayer requests is also important. A lot of times, you know, we give our prayer requests, but then it's never mentioned again, which just screams no one's even praying for this. And so someone needs to be, like Rick is saying, accountable for just being sure there's follow-up there, and so those prayer needs are honored and recognized and acknowledged.
Yeah, and Brian, I remember even as a kid, when I was in a Sunday school class, there was a Sunday school teacher who had us give our prayer request, and he wrote them down. He put them on the board, actually. And as God answered a request, he marked it off the board. That was the first time in my life I realized that God really did work and he did hear us.
Yeah, journaling works the same way, a prayer journal, but that's more on the individual side. What you're describing is more on the group side. That's excellent.
Yeah.
That's Jim Egli, E-G-L-I, and that post is 4 reasons why praying leaders have faster growing groups. No surprise there, right?
Great stuff.
So you can Google that and read the whole article. It's actually pretty short, and I think it'd be very helpful. And this may be something you want to engage the group on, or certainly for the small group pastors out there, something that you want to address with your group leaders when you get them together. So just maybe begin with that question. How are you guys addressing prayer in your groups? And here's some thoughts and ideas that you may want to take into consideration as you think through this part of what you do and asking God's guidance. So, Rick, we're going to have Jeremy Linneman calling in just a minute, and you and I were talking prior to the show, and you spent some time with Jeremy recently. So, tell us. So, what are you most excited about?
Well, I'm excited about Jeremy personally. He's a guy who is a young guy who is at one of the leading churches in the Louisville area, a really important church in many ways because of what the church is doing and how the church is doing it. We don't have time to get into all of that, but Jeremy is leading a group's ministry that is doing something that is, as we mentioned in the introduction, pretty controversial with some people, and that is multiplying groups. And now, Brian, it's never easy to multiply groups. People always in groups want to raise their voices and get upset because they're having to leave close friends. That's their perception. But they're doing it well, and they're doing it with passion. And he believes that if they can multiply groups, that perhaps they can make a huge difference on many streets and cul-de-sacs in Louisville, Kentucky, and beyond. So lots of satellite churches. I mean, this is a church that is really doing groups well.
If I lived in Louisville, I'd be checking out Sojourn. I know that. I was joking earlier when I said I'm against multiplying groups, but, you know, that is one of the mentalities that's out there. But the way I look at it is it's just like when you're moving. You know, we've moved. My family and I have moved. We moved several times, and each time we left behind friends. But that doesn't mean that they're not friends anymore. You know, the way that I've always positioned it is it's an opportunity to add to that collection of friends and those intimate relationships that are so dear and important to us and to the girls, to the daughters, and to Karen and me. And so group multiplication is the same way. It's not like you're never going to see these guys again. You're never going to talk. It doesn't mean that you can't still go out and have dinner together. What you're doing is you are participating in ministry and in the local church. That's really what we're talking about here.
Well, group multiplication is a necessity if we're going to bring the world to Christ. I mean, that's just a fact. Everyone says we want unbelievers in our groups. Well, you have to make room for them. So if you've determined the group is all about me, you know, make me happy, give me close friends, etc., group multiplication isn't for you. I mean, and that's what a lot of people in churches believe. You know, for years in the small group space, we pushed community, community, community. It was all about being in community. And in the process, I've probably said this before when we've had these conversations here, but we wanted people to become friends. In essence, we wanted them to stick. If people came to church and they got made some friends, they were going to stick. So pastors even pushed people to groups so they could make friends. Being in community is a very, very important principle. I mean, Scripture points that out again and again and again and again. I mean, to be in the image of Christ, as the Trinity was in community, we need to be in community. You then ask the question, though, that is a great principle. Is there a greater principle? And in my mind, yes, there is. The greater principle is that we evangelize and take people with us to heaven. And if we get in our holy huddles and never are willing to leave those people so that others can be engaged in a group because we want to be happy, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're bringing our higher principle of evangelizing others to God because we want to be happy. Happiness is not the goal of the kingdom of God. Bringing glory to God is the goal of those of us who are in the kingdom of God. And that demands that we sometimes set aside what we would consider weekly meetings with friends to bring unbelievers into groups so that they can become eternal friends.
Well, I think we've got Jeremy on the line. Let's see what he has to say about it.
Hey, Jeremy, thrilled you're with us, man. We are looking forward to hearing from you about group multiplication. The folks are waiting to hear what you've got to say. We've shared with them about Sojourn doing groups and multiplying groups. So, okay, yeah. Jeremy, when the two of us got together for breakfast, you were telling me that Sojourn Church is hot on groups multiplying. I also know for sure that Sojourn is huge on being theologically correct and biblically directed. So could you give us some theological, biblical basis for group multiplication? Because, man, I get asked that question a lot.
Yeah, and I do too. You know, it's a blessing being in a church that's so theologically sharp. We've got a lot of our leaders that want to know, you know, what's the biblical reason for doing this? You know, how does this fit into our theological grid? And so for me, the big thing is that we see throughout the Bible this pattern of mission. And you can see it from start to finish, but essentially the pattern is that God draws us in order to send us out. So you can think of the call of Abraham. You know, God comes to him and gives him kind of an experience of his glory and his presence, and Abraham moved in worship. And then, you know, God says, go, you know, I'm sending you to a new land, and I'm going to create a new people from you. You see the same thing in the call of Moses. You know, go, go to Pharaoh and take this message to him. You see the same thing with the disciples. They, you know, they have an experience of Jesus, and then they have to leave their nets and leave their fish and follow him. The early church was the same way. And so part of what it means to be a Christian is that as you're being drawn into God's presence and as you're growing in knowledge of God, that's not just for you, that's so that you can be sent out. And so one of the things we say here is that we're blessed to be a blessing. You know, if community group has been a blessing to you, then let's not end that blessing with you, but instead let's seek to take that out to others. So we're always about continuing that pattern of mission and having groups that are open to outsiders, that are multiplying, because I think it's just essential for our formation as Christians that we're participating in the mission of God.
Thanks, Jeremy. Hey, this is Brian Daniel, a co-host. Great to have you on the show, and great meeting you. It's always good to be with another Kentucky fan. Oh, am I sorry? I stepped out of line.
Yes, he said he was a Louisville fan.
See, I've got a block on that kind of thing. I didn't even hear him. I didn't even hear him say that.
It's an illness.
Yeah.
A malady. All right, so here's the second question now, because this is the one. When you get pushback from group leaders, because you know, there's a lot of energy and effort that goes into building groups and building those relationships, a lot of intentionality. Mm-hmm. And not saying that up there at Sojourn that you guys get pushback, but when you know, if you did, about people and their group doesn't want to multiply, so what do you say, or what do you do to get them to get them seriously consider becoming a multiplying group?
Yeah, it's a good question, and again, that's one that does come up a lot here as well. And it should come up, you know. I mean, we talk about community group being a place where you not only have friends and you build relationships, but it's a place to belong. You know, our world moves so fast, people's, you know, relational circles are expanding, so you've got relationships in all these different areas of life. And so we want community group to feel like home to people. It's not just a night of the week, but it's a way of doing life together with these people. And so, of course, you know, multiplication is going to be really, really hard. And the longer a group has been together and the longer this set of individuals has been together, then the more they're going to be connected and bonded, which again is a really good thing. So usually when we get a lot of pushback from the group, from the leader, it's a group that's been together for a while. And so the first thing we want to do is just sort of draw near and listen. You know, what are your concerns? Sometimes there's another concern besides just maintaining relationships. But typically that's what it is. And so through our coaching structure, we try to equip our coaches to just listen well and walk them slowly through the biblical foundations for multiplication, but also the pastoral reasons. And you know, every one of us was new to the church or new to the group at one point. And again, we just don't want that blessing to end with us, but we want to open up our lives and our schedules and our homes so that others can experience that blessing as well. And so we really try to walk with them pastorally. That might take a couple of meetings, or it might take 6 months. We've had groups that have, you know, gone 3 or 4 years between multiplications, and it's not ideal, but it's, you know, I think that's just part of, you know, leading in this context.
Jeremy, when you and I had breakfast, you were telling me about groups that would just conclude they're not going to multiply. I mean, I know we all deal with this. They just say, dude, you can talk to me as much as you want. Biblical understandings, I get it. Mm-hmm. I'm just not leaving these people. By the way, what percentage did you tell me of your groups do multiply? Because I think everybody that's listening needs to understand, even you don't get 100%.
No. So we are typically around 20-25% multiplication a year. And it's, you know, we're a multi-congregational church, and each of our campuses is at a different place. You know, they're a different age and have anywhere between 20 and 70 groups. And so the multiplication expectations are a lot different for a campus with 20 groups versus a campus with, you know, 75 groups.
Now,
so 20 or 25 overall.
I'm sure some people are sitting here saying, you only get 20% to multiply and you consider yourself a multiplying church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How would you respond to them?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways you could think about it, you know, ideally it'd be great to multiply, you know, 100% of groups every year. You know, it's easy for, you know, one of our teaching pastors to say, you know, if every group just multiplied this year, you know, what's the problem with that? What's so hard about that? You know, and I want to say back, and I often do, you know, if every one of our members brought a new friend to church and they stuck, then our church would double overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not necessarily that easy. Also, the other thing we're trying to balance is, you know, the care of our members, which requires really well-trained community group leaders, as well as the retention of those leaders, which requires really good coaches. And so if you multiply, you know, all of your groups every year, it might be a great thing in the short run, but in the long run, you might actually end up with a less healthy groups ministry. So for us, we're trying to stay ahead of the attendance growth curve and assimilate more people in the community every year. But 100% growth, I probably wouldn't get very much sleep at night.
Yeah, man, thanks for that that input on that topic, because I know I threw that question at you, but I thought it was an important one for people to hear. So let me come back to where I was headed, Jeremy, going with you. So I mentioned groups that just won't. I mean, you've got a leader that you've worked with for 3 or 4 years. You've been pastoral. You've been theological. Mm-hmm. You've been patient even. And they just go, dude, we're not going to multiply.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with groups that are just unwilling to carry out the church's expectations of multiplying?
He says, stop calling it a dude.
It's not easy, and again, it just depends on the reason. You know, sometimes it's somebody who's just wired as a great counselor and a great caregiver, and their strongest gift is to just really go deep with a small number of people. And if we've seen that and they're gifted in that area, that might be why they're kind of saying we don't want to multiply. And so what we'll try to do is help them shift gradually in a more counseling role. We do redemption groups and other types of group care here at Sojourn. And so one of those roles might actually be a much better fit for them than a community group leader. So that's kind of an ideal situation. If they're really just not making any progress and they're pushing back, or they're kind of just spreading, you know, gossip about the leadership or something like that, then we'll just try to ask them to step down for a season and reevaluate if this is the best place for them to be leading. A lot of times, if somebody's, you know, frustrated with our group's model and system, then they'll take that invitation to step down and you know, just be a part of a group. And we'll just try to continue to shepherd and love them well. And sometimes they come around, and then of course sometimes they don't.
So you will allow a group, if it just decides to continue on and on and on, you will allow them to continue to be part of your church's system, even if they don't ever multiply?
It just depends. I mean, probably after 3 or 4 years, we've got a few groups that we've allowed to do that, but typically they're groups with sort of extenuating circumstances. If there's, you know, several really big care needs in the church, or you know, if it's kind of a specialized group with, you know, families who have children with disabilities or something like that, then that, you know, that may be more appropriate for them. But, you know, we want 99% of our groups multiplying every couple of years. So it really just depends.
Well, Jeremy, I got to tell you, this has been a really helpful conversation. I know there are so many group pastors out there, and they're getting bombarded with different ideas on, do you stay together forever? Do you give them 2 years? Do you split them all up? Do you? And I think this has been real helpful. Brian, your thoughts on this conversation?
No, I was just sitting here thinking, out of the 20% that multiply, I bet you have to fight for 15% of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's just not something. We're creatures of comfort. You know, so once groups get comfortable together, and I know in my experience, the groups say, well, isn't this what you wanted? I mean, we're doing life together. I mean, so now we're just getting there. You want us to split this up, and really it just creates a more dynamic environment. But I really like what you said about, you know, we don't want the blessing to end with us. You want to perpetuate this blessing, and this is the way we do it, is through multiplication.
Yeah. Man, so we start our groups with that idea of multiplication. That's a big thing. If we can start that in the DNA of the group from the beginning, that's important.
That is great. Jeremy, I can't thank you enough for being with us, man.
Yeah, thank you, Brian.
Hey, appreciate
Thanks
it, Jeremy.
A lot, Rick.
Let's stay in touch.
All right.
I'll get you on the SEC spin.
Let's do it. I'm looking forward to it.
Take care of yourself.
All right, guys. Take care.
Hey, Rick, that was another great interview with one of our leaders out there in the field the church.
With a very courageous leader. Multiplication, as you even insinuated, is very difficult. You as a group leader, obviously, from what you said, you've experienced having to walk into a group meeting and say, folks, we need to have a bigger vision than ourselves, and getting that kind of pushback. So, you know, Jeremy is really doing a courageous thing and making a big difference through it.
It's all in the positioning, and I think what he said there at the end about making people aware up front that this is our group's ministry, this is our vision, and so it shouldn't come as a surprise. I think where you might get people that bristle at the idea more is if it comes as more of a surprise. It's not a part of the DNA. It's not built into the deal. So you're, in a sense, as a group leader, you're always working yourself out of a job. If that's your mentality, then I think that goes better. But I think a lot of time group ministry, they're so organic and they're so fluid, and you're always having to adapt and adopt to change. I don't know that the intentionality is always at the forefront, you know, in terms of multiplication. It becomes something that's like, oh, by the way, so if you've added this many people, you need to think about multiplication, which is a different scenario than building that in on the front end and saying, this is our group's ministry. This is what we do. This is how we bless each other. This is how we honor God in this ministry area.
Yeah, and let me just say one last thing about this. Many churches that train folks on doing groups are big, big churches. And they'll say there's no need to multiply groups. Don't sweat the multiplication thing. When you've got 100 guests coming every week, you got people you can place in groups, and you can create new groups because you got 100 people waiting in line. If you're a church that's growing a few families every 6 months, or, you know, even slower than that, or you're trying to start, you can't just wait. You can't just have groups that stay together forever, because there's going to be no place for a new family to move in. And you can't start a new group with just two families. So smaller churches have to think about multiplication. But the other truth is this. This is just a statistical fact. A church that's starting new groups is a growing church. Bottom line. Everybody wants to have a growing church. They think they're going to do it through worship alone. Many churches do grow their church through worship. But a church that's starting new groups will be a growing church if people are inviting their friends into their groups that aren't in a church.
Well, let me ask you just real quickly, just one more thing. He said there were, sometimes, now this may be the exception, but 3 to 4 years between multiplication, right? So there's a natural flow here to where you get to 18 months to 24 months, and you're at a place to where you have gained this familiarity and intimacy, but you've been together for 2 years. That may be an optimal time, that if you go beyond that, then you become more entrenched in the group. That even before, so conventional wisdom would seem to suggest that the multiplication would be easier the longer you go, you know, but that may not be true. There may be a more optimal time just in the natural flow of group life, right? I don't know if you've run into this or not, that happens before that you get a break to where you've almost... It's almost like an athlete that plays 3 years beyond his good years. He's still playing. Maybe he was still effective, or she, but she probably should have gotten out of the game before then.
Well, there are stages of group life, and you hope a group can get through all of those stages. And various groups will have those stages, will get through those stages at different amounts of time. But it has been proven, at least I've heard this for decades, that a group that doesn't multiply in 2 years probably never will. Because just as you said, there's an optimal time. Once you get past that, navel gazing becomes normality.
Well, as always, great insight. And I just want to remind everyone out there that Rick is on the road. We've said this before. How many days of the year?
About 110 days a year.
110 days of the year. And how many people do you think you're in front of?
Thousands.
If you had to take a guess, thousands. No. And how many one-on-one conversations do you have with people that are making these decisions and confronted with these dynamics?
Hundreds.
Countless. So, I mean, this is not just Rick drawing conclusions. This is Rick, you know, sharing what he – I mean, he's an aggregator, and he's bringing all of this small group knowledge and realities that we are in out there from all different parts of the nation. So, moving on. So, everybody's favorite segment –
Tweets of the week.
Of course, tweets of the week. You want to get us started off?
Oh, yeah. This is from Highlands at Highlands News. The tweet reads, "Create community by leading a small group!" Exclamation mark. Leader training tomorrow at 11:30 a.m. at every campus. Ted would love about that. Training at every campus. Here's just a fact. You never ask a volunteer to do something that you don't train them to do. And these people get it. They know that they must train these people to be leaders if they're going to be effective leaders.
How often do you recommend leader training?
As often as you have a new set of leaders. So it may be that a church does a leader training just prior to the beginning of the church year. And then after Christmas, if they're doing a campaign, even if they're doing short-term groups for 6 weeks, they need to give some training to the folks that are leading those short-term groups.
All right, tweet of the week from Melinda Taylor. This Melinda is at TaylorM304. Thanks, Melinda. And she says, "Amazed as God always knows when we need that extra support. He provides in a context from a friend." And I chose this one because this was, and I got a voicemail last night from a guy that I used to coach with, and the voicemail just said, "I love you. God put you on my heart. I was just calling to check in to see how everything was going." And I actually played that for my wife, and I said, this is the kind of voicemail that's just that I need to send more often. And so Melinda gets a text from a friend, just a text, hashtag grateful, hashtag small groups, hashtag family. It's actually spelled framly, but I think she meant family. And she's amazed as God always knows when we need that extra support. Without group life, I don't know that you get that kind of I'm sure you don't get that kind of redemptive community.
Well, we know this for sure. No one is strategically guided to live that kind of community in most instances unless they're in a small group. So that's important. Hey, let me jump into River of Life Church at River of Life. Here's what they tweeted. "Today is Serve Day. Small groups created their own project and served our community. It is an amazing opportunity." Man, I love that tweet. Whenever, you know, I have a dream to see a biblical small group within walking distance of every person on the planet making disciples that make disciples. What this tells me is that they guided their groups to be out in the community where that group meets, meeting a need. And when we do that, when we're living the gospel, people begin to believe us if we start talking to them about the gospel. That's a huge moment for that church. I'm sure it was a fantastic time.
Yeah. Yeah, we have serve days at Grace. You know, we call them like Super Saturdays, I think, or maybe it's Serve Saturdays, two or three times a year. What I'm trying to move us towards, you know, this tweet says that they created their own projects and served our community. That's great. I would like to see the church take more responsibility in sharing some of these opportunities. Because, I think it's the responsibility. You may disagree, but I think it's the responsibility of leadership to initiate this kind of culture with a running list, or maybe identify someone that just is in tune with what's going on in the community and the needs, so that groups, it makes it a little bit easier to go find those opportunities and get it started, and then that becomes contagious.
Actually, Brian, I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, when I planted the Bridge, a church in Spring Hill, Tennessee, we were about being on mission through our groups, and here's what we found out. We would tell them you needed to do a mission project every so often. We found out seldom did they ever do it until the person who was given the role of missions minister went out and created a list for them to work from. People that are working people don't have time to find a location, make the connection, etc. When our missions person took care of that for them, then they were willing to go do the ministry. So I think your assumption is an incredible truth, actually.
In an ideal world, all right, what's important to you, you make a reality, right? In an ideal world. The truth is, I think in this context, the reality is you just need a spark sometimes. You just need that little nudge to... And then from there, you can develop culture. I agree. Well, that's going to wrap it up for Tweets of the Week. Follow Rick at Rick Howerton, at Rick Howerton. My Twitter is at BC Daniel. We're always looking for these tweets of the week. We would love to hear your tips, any posts that you found, what's going on in your group, maybe what Bible study you're in. All of those things are good. So we're always on the look for these tweets of the week. Look forward to hearing from you sometime in the future. All right, Rick, let's move on to your the list for this is episode 13.
Wow.
So we're looking at Rick's list on episode 13, and we're talking about the four levels of relationships. So, Rick, why don't you take it from there?
Yeah, let me climb into this. This actually comes from my blog. It's four levels of relationship and why it's important to you and your small group. You know, when you think about it, there are four levels of relationship. As I was pondering this, these came to mind one day, and I thought, man, I ought to capture that. One is family, one is friends, one is acquaintances, and the final one is actually enemies. Let me give you a little information about each of those. Now, first, it's a family. A family is birth in blood. Either you're a blood relative, or you married into a family, or the blood of Jesus Christ brought you into his family, the church. And being a family is an inescapable lifelong commitment. You can't bail on that one. You know, that's just the way it works. You're part of that family forever. Family members share real love at the deepest human level, and the love family members have for one another is an instinctive love at the deepest level. So, when family members hurt one another, the hurt is at the deepest of all relational hurt. Family members forgive wrongs no matter what. At least they should. If they don't, they create havoc within the family, and family members have differences but are always willing to work them out. Now, when we move to the friend category, things change a bit. And some would disagree with me on some of my statements, but I think in friendship, most of these would be true, at least in my experience. Friendship is created when a common bond is created through conversation, shared experiences, common hobbies, common practices, or common beliefs. And being in a friendship can be a lifelong connection, but oftentimes it's for a period of time or until something separates friends relationally or geographically. And friends love one another at a surface level, yet real level. The love that friends have for one another is an earned love, and when friends hurt one another, the hurt stings and feels very personal. Friends should forgive one another, but if a friendship is lost due to lack of forgiveness, it's possible to walk away and feel no obligation toward that person in the future. And finally, friends have differences, but don't always feel obligated to exert the energy necessary to fix what is broken. Let me say that again. I stumbled over that. Friends have differences, but don't always feel obligated to exert the energy necessary to fix what's broken. When we get to that acquaintance area, I think it gets really interesting. I'd almost make a big divide between friendship and acquaintance. An acquaintance occurs when people meet periodically to be involved in a hobby, a cup of coffee, anything of that nature, or simply pass one another in the hallway at work or at church. Acquaintances can end any day. And acquaintances have no level of commitment to one another. Acquaintances don't know one another well enough to feel any level of love for one another. The feelings acquaintances have for one another is best described as appreciating one another's presence. And maybe that's a little deeper than it actually should be. Acquaintances seldom need to deal with any issues between one another. And then finally, there are enemies. An enemy is created when the heart of an individual begins to embrace that the person they're disconnected with is hurting them or attacking them or someone they love, and those people are no longer useful to them. Enemies don't want to be in one another's presence. Enemies despise one another. Enemies embrace the opposite of love for one another. They tend to hate one another. Strong words, but true in my opinion. The only conversation enemies tend to have with one another is in anger, as every conversation starts with believing that the other person is useless to them and attacking of them. And then finally, enemies tend to be on the attack and, because of this, never work out their differences. Now, why would someone need to keep any of this in mind? Here's why. A person will know if they are putting someone in a dangerous category or taking them down the category spaces, for instance, from friend to acquaintance, if they begin to have some of these feelings or speak some of these terminologies about that person. So a person may be a friend, then all of a sudden they start talking about them as though they're simply an acquaintance. or an acquaintance begins to talk, or a friend or acquaintance begins to talk about someone because they've had a falling out about them as though they are an enemy. A group leader needs to keep this in mind. If they can watch the language being used, they can sometimes determine if there's about to be conflict or if there has been a conflictual situation that they were unaware of. And we always, always, always want to help our group deal with conflict so that there will always be unity of spirit.
Yeah, that's awesome. So enemies I get. I mean, I don't know. In fact, I'm leading a men's group on the John Piper study, What Jesus Demands from the World. And the last demand was Jesus says, love your enemies. And so we wrestled with, you know, who really has enemies? You know, it got kind of global and macro. So enemies, you know, just in the everyday. Now, in a corporate setting that, you know, I am a part of a corporate setting, albeit it is very differently. I just don't think I have that. In a group, I don't know how often that happens either, but that difference between friend and acquaintance is profound.
Yes.
There was a guy that I used to be in a relationship with, and I was much younger, and he put this high value on friendship. And I couldn't understand, you know, he used such language as it was associated with friendship. And now, 15, you know, almost 20 years later, I really understand, I think for the first time, not today, but over the course of those years, what he was getting at, that there's this depth of friendship that's not to be taken lightly. It is a virtue. It is part of being human, and it needs to be addressed and emphasized at that level. And I think in group life, elevated to that level, that we talk about in redemptive community, what does friendship mean?
Well, and Brian, I think we want to keep in mind that when we come to Christ, we are instantly made part of the family of God. I mean, that's the analogy used throughout the New Testament, is that we are family. So when we first get a group together, they're acquaintances. They're not enemies. I don't think many people become enemies in group life, but sometimes it happens. But they are acquaintances. They don't realize yet, they've not experienced enough of each other to know one another in their hearts as family. So we want to help them move from acquaintances to friends, to living as family, so that they will never separate themselves from one another, always be forgiving of one another. The goal is to move everyone to a total understanding of who they already are in relationship to one another.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to, is so I think an understanding of the depth of relationship within the group, and I don't know how explicit the group leader would want to be in this language, I think in this way, but I think the group leaders listening out there, you need to know and be able to identify, like Rick has laid out here, where these levels are so you can see how these relationships are developing. You do want to move towards family and then split up and multiply.
No, you didn't have to go there, Brian.
but I do think the point is, I mean, that is, I think one of the things that must be said here is this is an unreasonable expectation at the first group meeting.
Yes.
Or the second group meeting, or the third, that this is a process and everyone is on a different is on a different schedule, and the group leader needs to be mindful of this of how these relationships are evolving and a group life is evolving, and just be able to see maybe where someone is not participating that needs a cup of coffee. You go talk to them and say, you know, this is what we're going after. Maybe ask a question, get to know maybe a better understanding of the person's story to understand how this is playing out in this person's life. But I think it's good stuff.
I think it's important stuff. I think we just need to know that we're trying to move people to an understanding of who they already are. They're already family. How can we help them move from acquaintance to friend to the realization that they are brothers and sisters in Christ?
Well, that's going to wrap it up for this installment of the Groups Matter podcast. Thank you, Rick. We'd like to thank our sponsor, The Disciples Path.
Yes.
This is 6 Bible studies that work as a unit, but also work a la carte. And it is a systematic discipleship that's been created to work in groups of maybe 3, triads or quads, all the way up to 8. I encourage you to check that out at lifeway.com/disciples-path. And so this is a 6-session volume, and the titles are The Beginning, the way, the call, the life, the truth, the mission. And the backstory here is that we were assigned, Rick and I were assigned this task of creating a systematic path of discipleship for the church. This is something that we had been asked for, Lifeway had been asked for. And so we pulled a group of, say, 15 people together, 15 disciple makers from across the nation, different churches, different sizes, even different denominations, brought them to Nashville for a two-day event with a white paper, and this is what happened over the course of, it was more than 2 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So really excited about it, a lot of buzz out there in the community, and we thank the Disciples Path for sponsoring this installment of the Groups Matter podcast. So glad you're with us, and look forward to being with you next week.